Let me just open by saying this. And if you'll use the handout, I'm going to give a lot of introductory stuff. You can take notes if you want to, but you'll probably be frustrated in it. You can get a copy of the tape. So I just ask you kind of relax, and you'll have a number of the verses that I give there. And if you want to jot down some verses, that'd be great. But you'll probably be less frustrated than trying to write down everything I say. And I think it's a thought more than the details anyway. Let me give you just a little background. And you guys, most of you are very involved in the business world, and so you know the situation as it is today anyway. But I would say that in an introduction to this topic of our ministry in the marketplace, that the marketplace is basically in shambles today. Some industries are in better shape than others. I've got a lot of facts here, and you really don't need to hear them all, but I'll just give you a few of the general things. The stock market in October 25th, 1929, when the Dow Jones Index was at 301, off a big from its high of the month before, it was still far above its level of the recent past. Inflation was under control and interest rates were modest. President Hoover assured the nation business is on a sound and prosperous basis. Within 20 days, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had fallen 34%. It continued downward, hitting a bottom of 2.5 years later of 86% off, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average would not reach 300 again for a number of years. And of course, we had the stock market failure, which this October, I think, just revealed a number of things that have been going on in the business community for a number of years. It wasn't based just upon recent history. In the 1960s, the average failed bank had assets of less than $7 million. In the 1980s, the average size had jumped to $176 million. Oklahoma is probably second in the nation in bank failures to the state of Texas. It used to be, as an independent businessman, when we went out and had lunch with our banker, he would say, "Kent, how are your sales? How are your profits? How's your net worth?" Today we ask them, you know, "How are you?" And it's a totally different atmosphere than it was. We could give you examples in oil, which I'm sure you've heard plenty about our part of the country, farming, real estate, the real estate market in Oklahoma and in Houston, Texas, and now in Dallas, Texas, and in many areas of our country are really just devastated. They're really bad. Savings and loans, 2 out of 3 of savings and loans are in serious financial problems and danger of failure. Someone has said that in the state of Texas alone, the savings and loans, the whole industry of the savings and loan industry in the state of Texas is teetering on failure. Debt, never in the history of mankind have people lent other people's money so foolishly. Instead of trying to correct the problem, they are compounding it by making other bad loans. Junk bonds, we know about that in the business world. Corporate debt. Debt servicing is now consuming 40% of the business cash flow. Consumer debt now represents 20% of a person's income, compared with 14% in 1982. In 1985 alone, 15 banks, the largest 15 banks, wrote off $1 billion of consumer debt. Government debt, when I was reading this, in 1984, the fiscal year, the official government stated deficit was $185 billion. If we had to keep track of it from accounting point of view, as you and I have to do in our businesses, it would have been a $333 billion deficit. In 1981, the government deficit was 15% of net private savings. In 1985, only 4 years later, it represented 76%. Bank debt is at an all-time high. The FDIC, they own most of the real estate in Oklahoma. You know how bad a shape that they're in. The FDIC in Oklahoma is trying not to close down banks anymore. They're trying to work out things because they simply cannot afford to put that much money up at one time. They made all sorts of negotiations with them. Someone has said that debt is now rising much faster than savings, faster than income, faster than growth, and while all the time there's an overall lowering of debt quality, a highly dangerous situation. And so we see the headlines today of the tailspin shocks a high-flying market, the bull market turns to a bear, and collapse echoes worldwide. So what does the Bible have to say about that? Well, Jesus said in Matthew 7, he said this, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to the wise man who built his house upon a rock. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and burst against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded upon a rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act upon them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rains descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and burst against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall." Hear now, and Psalm 52:7 says, "Hear now is a man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted rather in his great wealth, and grew strong by destroying others." Psalm 18:11, "The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it as an unscalable wall." How frivolous. Luke 12, "And the rich man, again I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this night thy soul shall be required of thee. Then who will get these things that you prepared for yourself?" In 1 Timothy 6:17, "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment." I can tell you that in my own business, which God has blessed at times greatly, that last night we were staying at Bud's house, and Bud asked, as we were discussing last night, he said, "What are your business goals?" And I told Bud that the last business goal we had made was in about 1973 or 74. My brothers and I bought our business from my father in 1972. It was doing a couple of million dollars a year. We took it over in the spring of 72, and we lost all of it in 17 months. There were some military bids and some money under the table, and we lost all the family business in 17 months, the perfect success story. And so we looked at each other across the desk in 1973 as going into the 74 and said, "What would God have us to do?" And we decided to try to go into the business world. And so we had to struggle and start our business from scratch. We had made our goal in 1974 or so. Our goal was to get up to $40,000 a month in sales, close to $500,000 a year. We thought if we did that, and we did all the work, and I mean stock boy and buyer and salesman and delivery man and everything, that we could make a living for both of our families and our employees. And that was the last goal that we've had in our business. In the year of 1977 alone, we lost 40% of our business and still had an increase at the end of the year because we got other business to make it up. But I believe today that the business world is in shambles, and our industry that I am in is in shambles. Four distributors have gone out of business within the last 18 to 24 months, and the creditors, the unsecured creditors, got nothing out of those four businesses. One that we had some to do with, the creditors were able to get some money out of it. The manufacturers are now going into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Our business has been teetering in our industry for some time, and now the manufacturers are beginning to go into bankruptcy. Leading retailers, many of the leading retailers, if you look at the newspapers today, are really, if they were not in some of the other businesses some of them are in, would be having even more financial difficulty. Revco, who was a bright star in the drug industry just a very few years ago, has teetered on financial collapse in the last couple of years. Not since the Great Depression have we had the opportunity, I think, to share Christ in the marketplace as we have today. But there's some other reasons besides business failures that causes this. Number one, the home. Divorce rates, single-parent homes, multiple marriages make the home less stable than it is in the past. And so therefore, when people come to you in the business environment where you and I are on Monday morning, they are interested because they don't have the stability of the home. The church. The church many times today, I believe, is polarized in various different directions. The church is basically more institutionalized. I don't know what it's like up here in North Dakota and Minnesota, but in Oklahoma, where we have a church on every street corner, the church is basically institutionalized today. And many of us believe that the work of the church happens within the four walls of the church, and we lose perspective of what our place is as laymen. The school is not allowing anything to be done, so we have no foundation there. And in our government, we see lack of principle, lack of integrity, and lack of leadership. And yet, increasingly, in recent years, Christians have shunned involvement in public schools and in government, and increasingly sought protection within the walls of the local church. The statement that I would basically use as our premise for today is the following sentence. It's my belief, as a businessman, that God has sovereignly planted each one of us here in this room today, where we are, in His sovereignty, with certain gifts and abilities to represent Him and to proclaim Him and His truth to our world. You see, I believe that before the foundation of the world, that God knew what you would be doing for a living Monday morning of this week, that God knew where you would be Tuesday afternoon, and that God has a design and has a plan for your life. Let me ask you a question in your own mind. Which is more spiritual, driving a truck or driving a church bus, being a church administrator or being a vice president of a large, being vice president of operations of a large manufacturing firm. Which is more spiritual, being a minister of music or a school teacher? Being a missionary or working in a retail store? Now you say, Kent, surely I can answer that. Surely being a missionary is more spiritual than working as a clerk in a retail store. I don't believe that it is, because God has placed both of those people where they are, being a pastor or being a salesman. The Lord knows that we have a lot of pastors, that we need pastors, but we also need salesmen who are out where they are representing Jesus Christ. Have you ever noticed why God called the people that he called? When he wanted to reach out to Pharaoh, he chose Moses from a royal family. When he wanted to reach governors and kings, he chose the educated and religious Saul. When he wanted to touch the lives of the common man, he chose Peter and James and John. When he wanted to affect the leading politicians and tax collectors, he chose Matthew and Zacchaeus. When he was looking for a way to reach the business community, he chose Barnabas and Lydia. Oswald Chambers said this. He said, "Never allow the thought of I am no use where I am, because you certainly are of no use where you are not." And many of us have said, "God, if you'll ever get us in a place in our life where we can really be used of you, then I'll really vocally share Christ and work where I am." But some of us need to realize that we need to start right where we are right now. God's not going to take us off and mystically move us to someplace else. The average layman believes that he or she is a second-class citizen and cannot make a contribution. Someone has compared the laity to a sleeping giant. While addressing the Lausanne Conference on World Evangelization, a friend of mine, Ford Madison, said that some church leaders have asked the laity to show up, put up, and shut up. And sometimes that's what we've asked them to do. Another person has said that God has placed us in our vocation to have us minister for him. We must use our vocation as a pulpit or a platform from which to share the gospel. He said it this way. He said, "The secular things that we do become spiritual if done for the eternal reason." In other words, my job that I'm working at in the wholesale business, selling Afro-Gene or Stay-Soft Road for a black to use in Mississippi or Los Angeles, California, as a distributor, becomes spiritual if while doing my job, the things that I'm doing have eternal value. On the other hand, the spiritual becomes secular if done for the temporal, which means that certain activities that I do in my church, and I'm committed to the local church, although I do a lot of speaking, a lot of traveling as a businessman, but if I do certain religious activities in my local church and I do them for temporal reasons, for approval of man and for other things like that, then basically those religious exercises that I go through become basically an exercise in secular works. And Jesus Christ says that either your work will be as wood and hay and stubble and it's going to be burned with fire, or that your work, whether it's in the church or in the marketplace or in your family or wherever it is, God says that some works will be as gold and silver and precious stones. Today, I think that in the example of Legion, the demoniac, that perhaps we would have handled Legion, and you remember the story of the woman at the well, that we might have handled them differently. Do you remember what Jesus said to the woman at the well? He said, "Go back and tell those." And remember, she went to the city and brought the people out to him, and she went back to where she was. Legion wanted to travel with Jesus, and he said, "I want to go with you." Christ had just taken the demons out of this man, and here he was, the one person, and everyone in the community knew who he was, knew what his lifestyle was, and he wanted to go with Jesus and tell his story. And Jesus said, "No." He said, "Go back to your home." Today, I would imagine if Jesus were to walk this world today, that we would have tried to have the woman at the well and Legion. Certainly, we would have had them at least on Christian radio. We might have had the television cameras there. We would have certainly taken our video cameras along. We would have had them on the circuit. We would have had them on the platform. But Jesus knew something that we don't know. He knew that where a person can really have a ministry is right back on the job where they are. At age 15... we're still in the introduction if you're wondering where I am, but at age 15, I felt a sincere call on my life for God to go in, from God to go into the ministry. And I was a very serious young man. In fact, I'd been so frustrated in my church that I was a leader in my youth group, and at about the age of 15, a few months before I felt the call of God, I came home one Sunday night with all the different literature that I had from my church packed underneath my arm, and I took it, and this is as a sophomore in high school, and I threw it on the edge of my bed, and I got down on my knees before God, and I said, God, if that's all there is to the Christian life, I don't want any part of it. And God said to me, he said, Kent, I am not found in a committee meeting. I'm not found in religious activities. He said, I'm found in a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, of which I was a Christian. I'd been one since 9. I've been trying to have a daily time with God since about 13. But I spent about 3 or 4 minutes with the Lord, and then I rushed out the door to do my activities as a sophomore in high school. And God said, I'm found in a relationship with my son. And he said, spend less time in religious activities and spend more time in trying to get to know me. And so as a 15-year-old boy, as a sophomore in high school, I committed to get up earlier each morning and spend an hour with God, and it changed my life. Within 90 days, I had led 3 of my friends to Christ. I took them out to A&W Root Beer. We went out to the lake. Underneath the tree, this was a guy, not a gal. We stood underneath the we were in the parked car underneath the tree. I didn't have any tracts like we have today, and so I just took out my Bible, and with a dimly lit Bible there, I shared the gospel, the plan of salvation. The guy prayed to receive Christ, and I said, that's pretty easy. So a few weeks later, I took another guy to A&W Root Beer, took him out under the same tree, led him to Christ. Within a few months, I'd led my friends to Christ. A few months after that, I felt a sincere call to the ministry. Then when I was getting ready to go to college, we had to ask some valued friends what I should do. And they said, well, if you really want to go into the ministry, you feel God's call into the ministry, what you need to do is go to seminary, number of seminaries that you can go to. But then some people advised us to go to a Bible school, and others advised us to get a secular education, get a broad-based secular education, then go to seminary. And so I went to the most secular university I knew, and that was the University of Oklahoma. It was very secular. And I went there, and I majored in pre-ministry, of which about 80% of the other guys that were majoring in pre-ministry with me were not even believers, I don't think. And I took a course of 13 hours of Greek my first 3 semesters of college. I took history. I took English. I took science. All the things that a minister needs to take, and I believe today that he needs to take those things. But I was not gifted and qualified in those areas. And about halfway through my first semester, my sophomore year, one morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, my dad called me and said, I just got your 2 deficiency notices. And if you want to continue to not only work part-time, but to work full-time and not have any of my support and go into college, then you continue to make grades like this. A few weeks after that, I was talking to the girl I was dating, who I was later to marry, and I said, you know, I'm really so frustrated, and I was really suffering for Jesus, you know, because I was doing what I thought he wanted me to do. And my wife said to me this. She said, Kent, are you sure that God has called you to do this when he's given you all these other talents and abilities in other areas, math and business, etc., and all the things that were easy for me, but I wasn't doing those because I felt like God had called my life to the ministry. And so basically, within a matter of a few weeks and after getting some Christian counsel, I changed my major to the business school and realized that perhaps God had not called me to that, but that he could still use me as a layman. Now, surely you guys have not had the same picture I had, but I visualized the Christian life as a ladder. And on the top rung was a missionary. And on the second rung was a pastor. And on the third rung were some Christian workers. And way down there, you know, near the bottom of the ladder was a layman. And I visualized that ladder, and I really never felt a call to foreign missions or to be a missionary, but I did feel a call to be a pastor. And I felt the call was genuine, but then it just seemed to all fall apart. So I changed my major to business. My grade point went nearly to a straight 4-point average. I mean, it was easy for me, and I witnessed to people, and people became Christians. And it was very easy to witness to them as a business student. It was very difficult as a pre-ministry student because then it was expected for me to share the gospel. I went to the Army. I came back to Oklahoma City in 1972, and I was frustrated because I looked at other laymen, and I said, this guy is an evangelist, and he's out sharing Christ, and he was a businessman that traveled, and another guy was a guy who was making disciples, and another guy was a leader. He would walk in this room, and we'd all follow him out, and they had all these characteristics. And I said, God, you know, when I left this church, I was a leader of the youth group. I was headed off to college. I was going to go into the ministry. I really prepared myself, but how come these guys are having the success? Why can't I be like them? And finally, God shared with me, after about 2 years of frustration in 1973-74, he said, Kent, I have not called you to be like other people. I've called you to be what I want you to be. And what I want you to do is to get prepared. I remember Gene Ward said in a Sunday school class that I sat in 15 years ago, he said, if you will get prepared, then God will wear you out. And so I sought at that time in the early 70s to get usable and be available so that God would use me in the ministry. And I can tell you that once I felt comfortable with that about 74 or 75, that I've given the last 14 or 15 years of my life to invest in my life in other men, basically through the local church that I'm involved in and then through a lot of other loose organizations and networks of businessmen. And I can tell you today that I do believe that God has called me and has called each one of us here in this room to be accountable to the Great Commission and to share Jesus Christ with others and to help build up their lives. And I think that we have just as much of responsibility as my pastor does. My pastor is the most supportive pastor that you could ever imagine. When I'm out speaking and doing other kind of things, he knows where I'm going. He's praying for me. I give him reports. He's very supportive of our men in our church. In our church, we've sent out a group of 8 or 9 businessmen that virtually travel all over the United States. And it's the most supportive pastor that you would ever see. And yet, my major ministry as a businessman is not teaching a seminar. It's not preaching in a church as I did last weekend or doing things like that. My major ministry is the marketplace where I am. And that's what we'd like to discuss with you today. Colossians 1, 28 and 29 says this. It says, and that's on your page at the top of the page, it says this, so naturally we proclaim Christ. We warn everyone we meet and teach everyone we can all that we know about him so that if possible we may bring every man up to his full maturity in Christ. This is what I'm working at all the time with all the strength that God gives me. Colossians 1, 28 and 29. See, it says that we're to proclaim Christ naturally, not through a stilted way, but you and I, in the marketplace where we are to naturally, by a result of our life, proclaim Jesus Christ. So therefore, I'd like to just cover 3 basic points. And before I do that, you know, I've just kind of given you a brief testimony, and some of you heard what kind of business that I'm in. Before we cover these points, do I have any questions? Anyone have a question so far? Comment? Okay. Look at number one. Number one, as I said, that God has sovereignly placed us where we are. I think we need to understand this. I believe totally in the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, both. Genesis 50, verse 20, Joseph said, you meant it for evil against me, but God meant it for good. And I believe that in times in my business, Bud and I shared a lot last night about some difficult times that we've had and that he's had, and I thought that those were meant for evil, but God meant those evil times for good. When we've lost our biggest customers, when we virtually were put out of business in 1974, when many other crises have happened to me in my business life, they may have been meant for evil, but God meant them for good. God is sovereign. 2 Chronicles 16:9 says this, the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, trust in the Lord with all thine heart and lean not into thine own understanding, but in all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. I believe that in the Bible we have the examples in the Bible of Joseph in the Old Testament. We have the example of Daniel. We have the example of Abraham. I get so frustrated when I look at the professionals today in our churches and in our parachurch groups and that kind of thing, and I think, why can't I do what they're doing? And can we not give our whole life to Christ, you know, all day long? And then I realize that if you look at the Old Testament, there were a few that were called to be the priest and the Levites. But basically, God, the godly men that God chosen, were also from among the laity. And God, the men of God that he used, were shepherds and were kings and were judges. In 1972, I shared with you how we lost our business. In 1977, a guy walked into my office trying to sell Afro picks. And as I told the long story to Bud last night, basically within a period of a few days, I got into the ethnic business of ethnic health and beauty aids. At that time, the guy came in. He said, why don't you sell these products for the blacks? And I said, I don't want to sell to the place where it's 100% black with bars on the windows. A guy may put a gun to my head. I don't know if he can pay the bills. I don't know if I can sell to the independent stores, etc. And he said, just sell to the chain retailers that you're already servicing to. And this salesman's rep took me out that afternoon, and we sold 5 accounts before I had any merchandise. Did not have any merchandise even for 4 or 5 weeks. for an investment of $5,000, we got into that part of the business. We were already selling pet supplies and other lines. And eventually took $7,500 worth of merchandise. And today I buy individual orders from companies at a time of $100,000 to $150,000, $200,000 at a time. Many orders of $50,000 truckloads. And it was because of a $5,000 investment, because God sovereignly placed that in my lap. I can take no credit for it because of genius, business expertise, hard work, or anything. He placed it in our lap, and we had to be responsible to him. In 1983, I'd lost a major customer, and I was going to lose it within the next week, and I was pacing back and forth across my front room. Maybe you all have done this, in reasoning with God. My family was gone, and I was walking back and forth, pacing the floor, and saying, God, don't you understand? You know, poor me. God, are you awake up there? Hello, you know, what's going on? And God began to speak to me and say, Kent, and he brought some other people to mind. A couple of months before, a guy had asked me to speak at a Christian retreat in Memphis, Tennessee, on marriage. And it was to be in April or May, and I had committed to yes. And then God brought these guys to my mind, and I called three different companies, and one of them was in Memphis, Tennessee. I called the guy, and I said, I'm going to be over there to speak in a Christian retreat, and I'd like to come and see your business and come a day early. Could I come? He said, yes, you may come. And I said, well, if you'd like to, I'd like to come over a day or and look it over. But I said, we're really even interested in buying some other businesses, and I'm not trying to be bold or aggressive, but would your business be for sale? And he said, well, come ahead. He said, it's interesting that you should call. He said, we have to decide this month whether to move our warehouse or whether to buy a new computer or not. And I later found out that he and his brother were not getting along. They were partners in the business. The wives did not even get along. They weren't even talking to each other by that time. And basically, we, as three Gentile brothers, bought the business of two Jewish businessmen, and that does not happen in the business community. But God sovereignly opened that door. There was a company in California that we tried to buy several years ago. We could not buy it. We bought many small distributorships in order just to open up doors. And many times God has just opened up this door, and I tried to do that. And this year, the guy called me up and said, you talked to us several years ago, would you still like to buy the company? We flew up to California and bought it. Between 1977 and 1983, our business expanded at an average rate of 49% cumulative every year for 7 years in a row. And the only thing that I can explain that by is by the grace and sovereignty of God. But then last year, our business went down dramatically. The worst year we had ever had in terms of drop in percentage in 1 year, our sales were down about 18 or 20%. We had hardly ever had a loss in sales, and our profits dropped over 50%. And yet I believe that God was sovereign in that year just as well. And the question that I would ask you that says, number one there, it says, do I believe that God has divinely placed me in my job? And I would ask you that question. Whatever you're doing, whether you're in Christian work, whether you're in the business world, whether you're retired, whatever you are, I would ask you today, do you believe that God has divinely placed you in your job? And if you don't believe that, then I think you need to change jobs. Get another job first before you quit what you have. But I think you need to believe that God has divinely placed you in your job. Then look at number two. It says, we are frustrated in our ministry because of separation, number one, segmentation, number two, and lack of ministry, number three. Yeah, that way you don't have to worry about it. Okay, Psalm 53, 2 and 3. Says that God has looked down from heaven upon the sons of man to see if there is anyone who understands, who seeks after God. Ephesians 4, 11 and 12 says that God has given some as prophets and some as evangelists and some as pastors and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry to the building up of the body of Christ. And God has appointed each of us to do different things in the body of Christ. And I believe that many of us as business people are frustrated because of separation and segmentation of our ministry. And I know that this has been true in my own life. You see, for many years, even though I was comfortable in the ministry, it was basically in the context of the church, and I did not realize the opportunities that I had in the business world to do the things that I could do. I have opportunities in the business world, and you have opportunities every day that my pastor or a Christian worker could never have that kind of an opportunity. I said this, the non-Christian may be separated from God, but the majority of Christians are separated from the non-Christian world except in their jobs. Now, maybe you're doing a better job than this than me, but unfortunately, most of my friends are Christians. Many of my friends, we've had to work to have non-Christian contacts because we feel comfortable around Christians. Sometimes we evangelize, and if we do, then they become Christians, and so we grow closer to them. Most of our closest friends are through the church, and that's fine. But the only place where I really come into contact with non-Christians, basically, is through the marketplace. So therefore, I need to take advantage of that. And then look at number B. Our lives are segmented. Family, church, job, and social. Many of us as business people have said, well, that is my family life, which is separate from my business life, which is separate from my social life, which is separate from my spiritual life. And they should be intermingled. One of the greatest things that we've been able to do, I think, in being in business for ourselves is to have our kids work at least some every summer. And we start them at a very early age, and we'll start them out a few hours a week and then a couple of days a week, and then they work 5 days a week. And so many kids today say, well, I don't have an opportunity to work. Well, I think the value of work is immensely important in the Christian home today. So I think you need to combine family and business. And I think you need to combine your spiritual life and your business life, etc. So we don't need to segment those things. I say number three, the average church is taking the man from the marketplace to help minister in the church when we need to be taking the man from the church to minister in the marketplace. Now, I go to a church in Oklahoma City that's one of the most aggressive churches around. It's a good church. It's grown. It's tripled in size the last 7 years. Still a fairly small church. But we're still battling that in our church, because the tendency is to have a building and have some walls and to develop a program. And the more program that you develop, then you need more staff members. And to give you an idea, I travel to a lot of churches. I traveled to a church last week. I was in Borger, Texas. And Borger, Texas is a church that runs about 700 to 800 in their morning services on Sunday morning. And I think they have a staff of about probably 4, maybe 5. Our church runs around 400, and we have a staff of 3 or 4, plus some secretarial and other kind of things. And then another church in Oklahoma City that I spoke at recently runs about 1,800 on a Sunday morning, 16 to 1,800, one of the largest churches in Oklahoma City, and they have a staff of 10 or 12 people. Now, what I'm saying is that the larger the church that we get, the larger the staff that we create. And the larger the staff that we create, the more those people, their job is to build programs for which the laity to be involved in, and the tendency is, and I'm just saying what the tendency is because I've been in the church all my life, the tendency is that we get involved in that program and we're pulled away from the very marketplace that we need to minister in. So therefore, the tendency is for me not to have non-Christian friends. And I need to work to have non-Christian friends. I need to work to have dinner with a non-Christian. I need to work to share gospel with a non-Christian wherever I am. Instead of the layman helping the staff with their plan of ministry, the staff need to be training the layman to use their unique gifts in different ministries. The church is to be a sending body. And I just say that because I'm not talking on the church, but I am talking about the layman being involved in the ministry. And I think that we need to look at all of our churches, and I don't care how good they are, and we need to say and talk it over with our pastors and our staff members that we're close to, etc., and say, how can you help me to be a better man in the marketplace? What can I do to help Jesus Christ in the marketplace? What can I do to help our church? Are there some unique things that our church can do in the business community that can have an impact for Christ? And churches are beginning to do that with the marvelous types of ministries that we have. One of the greatest things that's being done in recent years are many evangelical prayer breakfasts and other kind of things that are sponsored by the Christian community, endorsed by the church, but also endorsed by the marketplace. And we brought those together, and people will go to a prayer breakfast that will never darken the doors of a church. And many businessmen and businesswomen are finding Christ in that. I shared with you part of my business testimony. In a D there, it says, the Bible says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 13 through 16, Christ talks about the uniqueness that we need to have in our life. And he said that, Kent, when you're out in the business world and selling Afro-Sheen and selling to retailers and buying from suppliers and dealing with your employees and dealing with other competitors, he said, you need to be salt. He said, there needs to be something about your life that is like salt. And that means that you need to be a preservative to the community they're in. That means that you need to have an action, be a causative, be a cause and effect relationship. We need to be different. We need to be unique. And I'm afraid that many of us today are not salt in the business community. I'm afraid that at times I blend in just like everybody else. Is there a uniqueness in my life? And I'm afraid that many times there's not. Am I light? Am I light in a dark community where God has placed me? Or am I just blending in with the rest of them so that you can't tell any difference between our business objectives and someone else? We are surrounded by materialism today. And the more successful a guy becomes in business, the more materialistically we are. In Oklahoma, our state was devastated by materialism. I mean, we had guys that got into the cowboy thing, and they were spending money on alcohol and on clothes and on cars and on all the things that go with that because of all this tremendous money that had come in with the oil business and everything that had come with it, and we were extremely successful. But then all of a sudden, that materialism took a dive, and today, people are more interested in spiritual things in Oklahoma City than ever before, because in my Sunday school class that I'm in as a member of, I believe out of the 8 to 10 couples that are in there, two of them were unemployed at one time and now they're both working again. But it's not that they're unemployed, it's just that they're making 40 to 60% less than they were before. And when a guy starts making that much less, then he becomes interested in spiritual things. And I don't know about the climate up here, but down there in Oklahoma today, people are interested now because they want to know, is there a meaning and a purpose to life? We have a passiveness, particularly among men. We have a passiveness that we're just not interested in spiritual things. That's up for the women to do. And many movements today, Bible Study Fellowship, Christian Women's Clubs, many interdenominational movements are doing a great job among the women, but it's very difficult to get those same movements among the men because we're so tied in to the business world. I cannot tell the difference between many of us that are Christians and the non-Christians. Number one, I can't tell the difference in the way we pay our bills in business. Let me ask you. In your business, if you're in charge of it, or, you know, the ownership of your business, are the way that they pay their bills, is that different from the normal business people? What about the way that you personally deal with your finances, etc.? What about the staff people and the people that you know that are in Christian ministry? Are you providing them with an income, and are they using practical principles so that they can pay their bills on time? One of the biggest problems we have in the Christian community is that many of us do not pay our bills as well as the pagans pay them. So therefore people say, well, you know, he's no different than I am. I see that pervasive in our society today. Another thing is that we are not Christian workers. It seems like the more we get a guy in the church, the more of a milquetoast he becomes in the business world. So therefore, he comes out there, and this is the honest-to-goodness truth. We have hired teenagers in the summertime at our business. And you tell me, which works the best, a Christian teenager or a lost teenager? Which one? The lost. Why? Why do they work better? For one thing, they're more greedy for money. Hungry. And now that's not a good testimony, is it? I mean, to take the teenagers from the best homes in your church and put them there in our warehouse, and to take the lost teenagers, and the lost teenagers will outwork them 50%. So what I'm saying is, we have got to change what we're preaching on Sunday morning. We've got to change what we're teaching. Many of you are probably in positions of leadership in your churches. And I'm saying, let's go back to our church and let's take some of the Bible studies that we've done and set them aside, and let's go to the New Testament and say, what is to be distinctive about a Christian on the job? Are we to work? Is our work? I think a Christian's work should be just as good as a non-Christian or better. I think it should be a step above. And we've got to take that and permeate our community. Then we're shallow. I believe that many of us as Christians today are walking around just like we've been immunized, and there's no depth to our life. We've just gotten a shot just enough to do this for a few days. I had to start taking allergy shots 6 or 8 months ago. I was always critical of the people who had to take allergy shots. I don't know what it was, but I just had something in my mind that I thought, well, you know, there's a person. And I was just critical. And finally the doctor said to me, I was having so much trouble with sinuses that I had nosebleeds and all sorts of problems and everything. He said, have you ever considered that you need to take allergy shots and get tested? And I got tested. And sure enough, he said, you know, you're allergic to all this pollens and all this stuff that's in Oklahoma. And with our winds, which are kind of like yesterday up here, not quite that bad. And so what I did is I started taking allergy shots. And that's the way some of us are. We go to church once a week, and we get our immunization. And therefore, we've gotten just enough to be dangerous, but not enough to be distinctive in the marketplace. and we're not applying what we hear. And we're void of men who are leading with integrity. I think we need more men. I mean, I'm glad we got all men in here. I think we need more men that will take the lead in our families, as Gene talked about in the session this morning, to be the spiritual leader in our home. I thank God that my wife is a gracious, godly woman and a spiritual woman. But praise God that she's looked for me to set the tone of spiritual leadership in our family. And we cannot let the women and children do it, because the children are looking for the father and saying, what is he doing in the Word of God? Is it making a difference? And if we're one way on Sunday and at home, and another way when we're on the job on Tuesday afternoon, if your son or your daughter cannot follow you around on Tuesday afternoon on the job and see you representing Jesus Christ, then we need to change the way that we're doing it on the job. And you say, well, Mel, you don't understand about this. But I mean, I do understand. And again, we were talking last night, and there are distinctives in business that we have to understand, that I'm not talking about a milquetoast businessman. I'm not talking about a guy who does not stand up for what is right and that has to have a bottom-line profit and all that kind of stuff. But I am talking about distinctiveness on the job that our children or that our employees can tell that we're a Christian. And the second question I would ask you is, do you believe that God has called you to the ministry? Everyone in this room has been called to the ministry, to the same way that your pastor or a missionary has been called, because we've been called to the business world. And the third and final point is, our marketplace should be our ministry. In Matthew chapter 9, Christ talks, Matthew chapter 9, verse 10 through 13, he talks about the story of meeting with the sinners. And the Pharisees asked him and said, why is your teacher eating with the tax gatherers and sinners? And Jesus heard this and said, it is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice, for I did not call the righteous, but the sinners. Let me ask you, how much are we eating with the sinners? I'm afraid that I don't eat with the sinners enough. Are you spending enough time with the non-Christians on the job to be exposed to them and realizing that the marketplace should be your ministry? I think God wants us to be successful, but not necessarily monetary. My idea of success is being in the will of God. And I think that we need to integrate our jobs and our ministry. And I'd like to give you some examples. There was a guy a few couple of years ago whose name is Randy Atkins, who showed up in my church in my Sunday school class. He'd been led to the Lord by another denomination and showed up in my Sunday school class, and I spent some time with him, and he was in the beer business. He was a distributorship, in the beer distributorship, and he was a supervisor. And he came to me and he said, Kent, what should I do about, you know, I'm in the beer business and I sell beer for a living. And I said, well, first of all, you need to find out whether God wants you to be in it, and if you want to get another job, well, then get another job first before you quit that. But I said, has it ever occurred to you that you're now a Christian and God wants you to minister to the other guys that are selling beer with you and to your employer and to your customers? And he said, no, that's never occurred to me. So he just started being evangelistic, and he'd share Christ with the store managers and with everybody. And this guy, in addition to doing that, had a couple of kids, and he was an official. And he referees football games. He does a lot of umpiring in the summer, particularly with baseball, and he does basketball. He has now started in the state of Oklahoma. He's not very well educated. He's not very flashy. He's not, you know, what you'd call a guy in a coat and tie and that kind of thing. He's just a down-to-earth person on the street, salesman type. And he's an athlete, and he's taken these other officials who are Christians, and they formed a loosely knit organization, and it's their goal to go into every small town in the state of Oklahoma and to officiate a game and to share Christ with the football or the basketball or the baseball team before the game. And he's doing it. And he works with FCA, and he can go in. And guys, this guy can go into places that you and I could never go into, that I could never take my pastor into, but he's going in there because he's an official. And his desire is to take a map and plot down every city and to write a letter to those athletic directors and saying, here's what my goal is, and we'd like to officiate one of your games sometime in the next couple of years. And sometime the rest of his life he wants to share in every community that he can across the state of Oklahoma. Now that's what I call taking one affinity group and saying, we're going to reach our state for Jesus Christ where we are. And you see, I think we've got to get out of our four-wall mentality that the ministry only happens in four walls, and we've got to say to ourselves and strategize and sit down with your pastor, sit down with other leadership in your church, sit down with other businessmen who could be from different churches. You know, Lord help us, even from different denominations. And when I come to conferences like this, I don't walk up to anybody and say, what church do you go to or what denomination you're from? If they love Jesus Christ and they want to share Jesus Christ with other people, then I want to work with them. And it's amazing what barriers we can knock down when we get back to the truths of God's Word. But anyway, get with your people in your church and in your business and strategize and say, how can I reach those people? We're doing a number of things with our employees. We have a chaplain. I don't know if I told you this, but we have a chaplain in our company. We have 200 employees. We have about 120 in Oklahoma, and the other 80 are scattered out over 16 states. My brother came to me a couple of years ago and said, Kent, do you know that 60% of our employees will never darken the doors of a church? So when they have a death in the family, what do they do? When they have a marriage in the family, what do they do? When they have someone that goes to the hospital, what do they do? And they need someone to minister their spiritual needs, but they may not want to come to me as one of the owners or managers of the firm. So what we did is we contracted with an agency, a guy who had been a military chaplain, so he's used to working with various denominations and religions. And we contracted with him, and he works for us so many hours a week as our chaplain. He comes in and he meets our employees. When someone goes in the hospital, he visits them in the hospital. When somebody has a problem in the family, he meets with them. If there's counseling, he meets with them. A number of our employees have become Christians through him sharing Christ with them. He does not share with us what their problems are. He does not share with us confidential things. He's just there as a service for our employees to minister to them. And it's had a dramatic impact upon our people. But there's so many things that you can do. We send our kids to a Christian camp. It's non-denominational, so I'm not pushing any church. We send them all expenses paid, if they're 11 through 14, to the Navigators Eagle Lake Boys and Girls Camp in Colorado Springs, Colorado. We send them there every year for the last 10 years. We send any employee age 11 to 14 their children. What more can I do for my employees than to send them to a Christian camp which shares the gospel with them, which builds discipline into their lives, which builds the Word of God into their life? I mean, the parents will do anything for us. Guys, I had three men sat at a table, three grown men sat at a table with me just 2 weeks ago at my sales meeting, and they looked me straight in the eyes and they said, Kent, the only way that you're going to get us out of this firm is to fire us or run us off. He said, we are totally dedicated to this family and to this firm. I mean, if you build that relationship with your employees and those under you, you've got them for life. And so what we've tried to do is to make our company distinctive. I was, we had a bonus plan. How many of you have a plan like a 401k where you work, or a bonus incentive plan or something like that? A couple of you do. Okay, 401k, you can match so many percent. We had a bonus plan that, and we had to change it when we really cut back our profits last year, but it takes 8% of a person's income. If they make $100, they put in $8. We match it with $8. At the end of the year, if we're profitable, we'll match it up to another $4, which is the limit by the federal government, which is $20. They've only paid taxes on $8. The other $12 comes from us. We've got invested in commercial real estate, and it's making 13 to 15% a year. The guy that figured out this plan said to my brother, you cannot do this, because if you do this, you will be giving away too much money to your employees and you'll have them lined up down the street to come to work for your firm. And he said, that's exactly what my goal is. I had a guy who's worked for our firm 10 years tell me, sitting in my backyard a few months ago, who happens to be a Christian guy, but it could have been one of our non-Christians, and he said, you know, I've decided that, you know, I'm going to have so much money in this plan that I can retire at a certain age. What I'm doing is we're taking care of not only our spiritual benefits, but financial benefits for our employees. And if you take care of them, and if we have that kind of illustration, not just try to milk from the person the most you can, but to practice the biblical principle. It is more blessed to give than receive. I was speaking for Leighton Ford in Augusta, Georgia a couple of years ago, the home of the Masters. And a guy came up to me who's a veterinarian named Tom Proctor. And Tom came up to me after the 4 weeks of the class. He said, Kent, I've just realized something. He said, I've been in veterinary medicine for 10 or 15 years, and I finally realized that I can be a veterinarian for Jesus Christ. He said, you've changed the way that I'm going to live my life. And the desire of my life is, my life verse is Philemon 1:7, which says, brothers, we've had much joy and comfort in your love because the hearts of the saints have been refreshed through you. My desire is to refresh the hearts of the saints, to encourage them to represent Jesus Christ where they are. A couple of years ago, I was asked to go to Chicago to visit with the staff and the executives of the largest black firm in the black health and beauty aids industry in Chicago, Illinois. It's an $80 million firm. So they flew me up to Chicago. That night, I had a very nice meal in a hotel there, a steak dinner, with their executive VP and with their regional manager. They put me up in a hotel room. The next morning, I got a tour of the plant. The next afternoon, I met it with a board meeting through all of their top executives. That was also my most embarrassed moment in my life because I got a stomach virus or something, and so I would meet with them for 30 minutes, run across the hall into the boys' room, and I'd throw up my cookies, you know, and come back and meet with them. It was the most terrible meeting I've ever had in my life. But anyway, I got to do all of that. I came back, flying back to Oklahoma City, and I asked myself this. I said, Kent, your business did not pay for this trip. You did not pay for it personally. Your church did not pay for this trip. My supplier, I'm their customer, they paid for the trip. I got to share Jesus Christ with those guys the night before. I got to meet individually the four family members that own that firm. I got to write a follow-up letter with each of them and share Christ with them, and have since before and after. And we spend millions of dollars to send missionaries to Africa and across the world, and I buy into that. I'm for that. I give my money to do that. But in this world system that we men in this room and others like us in our churches, we're being paid by what? The corporate secular system that we work with to travel around the country. And who pays the bill? We don't. Our church doesn't. The corporate system that we work in pays the bill. And evangelism, if we realize that, we could cut our budget on evangelism for here in the country and send it overseas, because we can do the evangelism here in the country just with the Christians that travel for a living. Can you imagine if every Christian that traveled for a living really shared Christ as he went about and began to fellowship with other Christians and share with the non-Christians? We wouldn't need an evangelism budget for this country and our churches. In M&M, there's a story about two fellows, and the firm's name is M&M, in Atlanta, Georgia. I shouldn't have said the name on tape, but a couple of years ago at a business meeting, a black gal came around up to me. It was 11 o'clock at night after an awards dinner in Atlanta, Georgia, and she said, Kent, I've got to tell you a story. And I said, okay. She said, you know, I'm a Christian, and I'm one of the few Christians on our executive board of our entire firm. But she said, your name was brought up at a meeting that we had this afternoon. And we were talking about distributors that took advantage of us and did certain things which were not right morally. And one of the firms said, but there's one guy that does not do that, and that's Kent Humphreys and those people with Jack Service. And another one said, who's a non-Christian, these are all non-Christians, the other non-Christian said, but that's because they're Christians. And she said, it just dawned on the group, and it dawned on me that you had a witness there, and they'll never tell you that story because, you know, they don't want you to know what kind of an impact you've had on their life. But you had an impact in our executive board meeting because of the way that you pay your bills, the way that you treat your suppliers, etc. A couple of months after that, one of the founders of that firm, the president of that firm, was in my office. And I work a lot with Billy Graham, and we had some Christian Life and Witness books, you know, the brown book or the blue book that you use in the crusade. They were sitting over on my credenza. So I spent an hour and a half with this guy, the president of the firm, the marketing manager, and the sales manager. As they're leaving the office, the gal who's the marketing manager said, Kent, did you see the film, The Cross and the Switchblade? And we were talking about this. And she looked down at the book and she said, oh, what's that? Can I have one? Had nothing to do with business. I didn't offer it to him or anything. And I said, sure, you can have one. And I just gave it to her. This wasn't set up. And the other girl who was with her said, could I have one? And I said, sure, you could have one. And then the president of the company said, can I have one? And I said, on one condition, that I want you to read this on the airplane on your way back to Atlanta. And he said, I'll be glad to. And I offered him a book. And he took it home. Now, the non-Christian community is asking us for help in our office, in a business environment, and we're not taking a track and shoving it down their throat. We had a plan. As I told you, we send our kids to a Christian camp, and we were going to send some scholarships to this camp in Colorado, and I decided, what could I do that could impact my industry for Jesus Christ? And so I wrote a letter this year. This has just been so fantastic. I wrote a letter to the top 13 manufacturers of leading hair care products for the black across the United States. About half of them are black-owned and half are white-owned. They range from Savannah, Georgia to Los Angeles, California, from Chicago to Dallas. And I wrote a letter to the CEO, of which I'm personally acquainted, and they've all been in my office. I've been in their office. I know them. And as a business letter, I said, look, we've gotten some businessmen in Oklahoma City to put together these scholarships, and we would like to send one of the employees in your firm, preferably a black employee, a black teenager in your firm, to go to this Christian camp. It's non-denominational, but it is a Christian camp, and we'll pay their entire cost for that. And they can either pay their travel, or you, as the employer, could pay for the travel, and we'll pay for the cost of camp for a two-week scholarship. Well, so far, I think about I've got eight out of the 10 places filled. One of the companies was in Memphis, Tennessee. A girl had just taken over for her father. Her sales manager called me back within a week and said, you couldn't have done anything better. She said, she just took over from her father a couple of months ago. We do have a heart for the black community. We're here in Memphis. We do some things. She liked the idea so much that we're going to send 9 kids, and we'll pay the ticket, and you're going to send 1. I later visited their firm, and they're only going to send 6 or 7. But so here we are as a Christian businessman. I'm sending a scholarship for 1 kid from Memphis, Tennessee, to go to a Christian camp, and their employer, non-Christian, does not necessarily practice Christian principles or anything else, is not a believer in Jesus Christ, I don't believe, but their employer is paying the way for 8 of those kids to go to that camp. That's what I mean by having an impact where we are in the business world. There's a number of other examples I could give you, but our time is up, but I would ask you this question. What things can I do where I am now to positively influence others for Jesus Christ?